We'd like to thank our friends at PwC for their support, partnership, and collaboration in making Retail Gets Real. Learn more about how PwC helps retailers at pwc.com.
Well, for us in the U.S., we do see light at the end of the tunnel. We do see things changing. It's not the same way for our producer groups in India, Bangladesh, Nepal, many other places where they're still dealing with these kinds of disruptions to life. And their infection rates, of course, are continuing to increase. But what fair trade has been able to do over the past year is continue to provide income for these people to help them navigate the challenges the pandemic has presented.
Welcome to Retail Gets Real, where we talk with retail's most fascinating leaders about the industry that impacts everyone, everywhere, every day. When 10,000 Villages opened its doors in 1946, it was a fair trade pioneer, offering ethically sourced, handmade products crafted by artisans from developing countries. In today's episode, we're speaking with Gordon Zook, CEO of 10,000 Villages, about how the organization continues its mission, helping to positively impact the life and community of its makers and villages around the world, even as consumers and the world of retail have evolved. But first, let me welcome my friend, my colleague, my co-host, Sarah Rand. Hello, Sarah.
Good morning, Bill.
How are you?
I'm wonderful. How are you?
I am well. So, Gordon, welcome to Retail Gets Real.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
So, Gordon, tell us a little bit about your journey. How did you get to 10,000 Villages? Where did that all begin?
So I began my career working in agricultural development with Mennonite Central Committee, or MCC, in Bangladesh. After that, moved back to the U.S., spent a brief stint working in agricultural finance. And then my wife and I spent the next 8 years working in Haiti and Bangladesh in MCC program leadership. During that time, I had increased exposure to the kinds of groups that 10,000 Villages buys its products from. And in many of those cases, we actually helped form groups, helped them develop their organizational structure, as well as products so that they could connect with 10,000 Villages and other fair trade groups. Spent some time after that in the U.S. working for a mid-sized family-owned construction and manufacturing firm, joined the 10,000 Villages board for a number of years at that point, and then also completed a PhD in organizational leadership to try to bring some structure to my practical leadership experience. Then my wife and I moved to India, where we spent 5 years working again with MCC in program leadership. And in that, since we source at 10,000 Villages about 25 to 30% of our product from India, that has given me some great insights into the reality of life for the makers there, the challenges, both the challenges that they face, as well as the difference that the income they earn by selling products to us and other similar groups makes. And then 2 years ago, as we were looking at finishing up that work, 10,000 Villages needed a new CEO. And my combination of domestic business and international experience fit the needs of the position they were looking at. So I joined 10,000 Villages as CEO in July of 2019.
Well, one thing I would say, Gordon, is that you haven't been bored. I mean, my gosh.
No.
So tell me about 10,000 Villages, a little bit of that history.
Mm-hmm. So 1946, as you mentioned at the outset, Edna Ruth Byler, who's a Mennonite woman from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, was visiting in Puerto Rico with her husband. They met some skilled craftswomen in the La Plata Valley of Puerto Rico who were struggling to feed their children. She looked and saw that they had handicrafted items, but they didn't have a place to sell them, particularly at a place that would allow them a fair wage. So she said, well, what can I do? She decided to bring some of their products back to Pennsylvania with her and connected with her friends and family to sell them and to begin to provide a market for these women's products. So by doing that, she opened up access to the American marketplace in a fair and transparent way, created a path for them to earn a sustainable income. And that was the start. From there, it grew into other countries and other communities here in the U.S. Initially, she started out by just traveling around in her white Chevy, doing essentially bazaar-type sales. It outgrew that, and she opened up a shop. And then under auspices of Mennonite Central Committee, it developed into a more formal organization, which has grown into 10,000 villages today. Also, along with that, it inspired many, many other people to do similar things. And so we are far from the only fair trade organization in the world. In fact, it's spread across the U.S., Canada, Europe, Australia, and now impacts millions and millions of makers around the world.
How many 10,000 village stores are there?
There are approximately 50 stores across the country that carry the 10,000 villages name.
Okay. And your online presence? I'm sorry, Sarah. I swear I'm going to stop. This is what happens when I'm really enthralled. I forget. It's not just you and me, Gordon. Sorry. So online.
Yes. So we have an online presence at 10,000villages.com. Started that about 15 years ago.
And how's that going?
Quite well, especially this past year. Over the pandemic period, sales in that channel have doubled, partly because stores were closed and everybody migrated online for a period of time. And so our challenge at this point is, how do we continue to capture that increased audience? And how do we continue to have them support us through the e-commerce channel? Because we think we've only begun to really scratch the surface of what's possible there.
I would love to know a little bit more about how sourcing works. I can envision what you're talking about at the small scale, but when you're so large and in so many places in store, how do you find, for lack of a better word, suppliers? How does that work?
So our model involves long-term relationships with suppliers. And currently, we're working with about 75 groups in 30 countries around the world. And the average length of time we've worked with those groups is about 20 years. And so we have these relationships developed, built up over time. And our goal is to provide consistent opportunities for them to sell their products so that it's not a feast or famine type situation. We want them to be able to count on the fact that 10,000 Villages is going to be there and continuing to make purchases. So out of that long-term relationship, what has evolved is a understanding of their capacity, what kinds of products they can make. We then work with them in terms of what kinds of products we can sell here in the American market and come up with products that we can pay them a fair price for and yet sell profitably.
I imagine that the pandemic has presented a number of problems that other retailers aren't dealing with because you have such a unique model. How has your team navigated that over the last year, and how are they continuing to navigate that?
Yeah, so we stay in constant communication with the groups that supply the product that we sell. They are the ones that are involved on a day-by-day basis, working with the individual artisans to keep them healthy and safe. In that, and what we have to do is work with the various restrictions that they're under. So sometimes production gets delayed, sometimes shipping gets delayed. But by staying in communication, we're able to navigate that somewhat better and at least be aware of the changes we need to make, the adaptations that have to happen on either end. And we've had to also rely on them in certain sense. Situations because when stores close and sales dry up, that creates some cash flow issues for us as well. So it's been a two-way street, us counting on the artisan groups and the artisan groups counting on us.
75 groups, 30 countries. Does that grow and shrink, or is it pretty consistent, manageable? You just like to keep it at 75?
At this point, it's manageable. Our goal would be to grow that. In the past, we have worked with more groups, but as the retail market has shifted here in the U.S., we've had to shrink some of that in order to stay focused appropriately and to make sure that we're right-sized with the market that's here. Our intention is to grow that again and to be able to work with smaller groups that have less of their own capacity, so groups that require more support from us. That's part of the future goals.
Do you work with NGOs, or is it really just directly to to the villages and the folks there that are doing the work? Is there any NGO involvement in that?
At this point, there typically are not NGOs involved, although many of the groups had their origins through NGOs like Mennonite Central Committee. So particularly in Bangladesh, MCC was integrally involved in forming many of the groups that we continue to buy from. They're now independent. They're their own. They are responsible for their own operations, but that's where they got their start. And so many groups around the world would be similar to that. They have an origin story, but at this point, they're independent and functioning on their own.
I'd love to talk a little bit about your consumers. I have been one for many years. You have a store in Old Town Alexandria that I love. Fair trade now is so much bigger than it was 5, 10, 15 years ago. And you guys have been around for, what was it, 1940?
Since 1946, so 75 46. Years this year, yes.
I don't know if you can speak to how long, how much the consumer's changed over that many decades, but even in the recent 10 years, who is your customer these days?
Yeah. So in the beginning, our early customers were in local communities, people that were either Mennonite or other faith-based communities. So people that were concerned about the economic justice part of the mission and got excited about that. More recently, customers have become a broader audience of globally minded citizens. They care about people. They care about the planet. They care about where the products that they're purchasing come from. They're trying to cultivate their own ethical style, and they want to be able to give unique gifts to their friends and family. So what we're seeing is a cultural shift where there's more and more customers whose values align with the products that they purchase. The ethical supply chain that we have and our environmentally sustainable practices are attractive to people. And so we're seeing an increase of that kind of consumer. People that are interested in what we've always been about and what we've always done.
So let's go on to the online side of things, because you've been doing it for 15 years. There's a lot of companies, a lot of retailers that haven't been doing it for 15 years. They've been playing catch up for 15 years. And so when you look at the growth there, is it less about creating more brick and mortar, more about putting emphasis on the online? Or are you thinking about expanding beyond the number of stores you have currently?
For us, it's a way to find a balance. As important to us as the product is the stories behind the product. So we always wanted to be able to have the two parts joined in what we're selling. And so in our stores, we have staff who are trained in the stories behind the product. They can ensure that, or they have more opportunity to engage with customers in the stores. Online, we want to be able to duplicate some of that. So we have to put the stories out there in a fashion that is attractive to the customer who's browsing for a particular product, right? So that it becomes more than just a simple economic transaction. We're connecting people in the U.S. with the people who have made these products. And we're helping them to understand some of the similarities in their lives and some of the same kinds of goals and aspirations that they have for their families. So to us, it would be important to continue to balance brick and mortar physical locations alongside the e-commerce. E-commerce, of course, allows us to reach a much, much broader audience than we can in our physical stores. Even with 50 stores around the country, we've only scratched the surface of the number of people that would be interested in the kind of products we have in our mission.
The storytelling aspect of what your employees do is so fascinating. I think that's fairly unique for you guys. I wonder how you collect those stories when you're working with your suppliers. How are you doing that research? How are you getting them to talk about where they come from and what they do?
Well, and again, that's a fruit of the long-term relationships that we've established with these groups. So in normal times, our buyers travel periodically to visit the groups. So they're spending time in India, in Bangladesh, in Haiti, at the actual production locations. And so they're interacting with the artisans. And part of what they're doing is helping develop new products or tweak existing products to better meet the market demand. Part of what they're doing is listening to and gathering these kinds of stories. Where does this craft come from? What's the history behind it? What does this income mean to you, your families, and your communities? So they're collecting those kinds of stories in those periods where they're working together. We also then rely on our partners, the artisan partners, to collect those kinds of stories and to share them with us so that we can share them with our customers.
You know, I love a good story. So if you were to go somewhere and somebody were to tell you, you wanted to tell them about the work that you've done and the impact that you've had with some of the suppliers that you use, what's one of your favorite stories?
Well, one of my favorite stories comes from Bangladesh. And of course, Bangladesh is close to my heart, given the number of years I've lived there. But a woman that 20 years ago started out working with one of the groups that supplies products for us. She lived in a very simple house. At that point, it would have been traditional thatched roof, mud floors. In the rural area where she lived, had very, very limited scope for ever making anything different. By being able to work with this group and the products that they sold to 10,000 villages, she's had a sustained income for the past 20 years. She was able to send her daughter to nursing school. So her daughter is not going to be in the same situation that her mother was in. She's got better, broader economic opportunities. And that's really, to me, encapsulates what we're all about. We're about giving people the opportunity to earn an income so that they can make changes in their lives and in their communities.
Well, and you stop the cycle. I mean, and that's pretty impressive. I think about the opportunity. I mean, in terms of where you see the future as we careen into post-pandemic 2021, going into 2022, what is the vision for the future for you, Gordon, and 10,000 Villages?
Well, so we are, of course, celebrating our 75th anniversary this year. So that's for us an occasion to reflect on what has happened and the tremendous growth we've seen both in our business and in other businesses similar to us around the world. So we're looking forward to sharing that story with people. We're also looking forward to, or I'm specifically looking forward to having the opportunity to talk about the role that fair trade has played over the past year in helping people cope with the pandemic. Because while for us in the US, we do see light at the end of the tunnel, we do see things changing. It's not the same way for our producer groups in India, Bangladesh, Nepal, many other places where they're still dealing with these kinds of disruptions to life. And their infection rates, of course, are continuing to increase. But what fair trade has been able to do over the past year is continue to provide income for these people to help them navigate the challenges the pandemic has presented. So one of the things I'm looking forward to is being able to explain that to people here so that they understand how critically important fair trade is. We're also excited about the opportunity to reimagine fair trade, to continue to keep it relevant for consumers in the U.S. in the 2020s. We have to stay abreast with the market. We've got to make sure that the products that we have are attractive and appealing to customers. They fit the lifestyle that people here want. Our vision is that one day, all artisans in developing countries will earn a fair wage, that they have been treated with dignity and respect, and that they're able to live lives of quality. So that's what we're looking forward to continuing. As we've navigated store closures and store reopenings and all of the struggles of that, the opportunity to expand this mission is what really excites me.
That's fantastic. And I'm hoping that people out there that are listening to the program understand that that is not only an admirable goal, but a goal that you've been working on for 75 years and have had a really quantifiable impact. And for that, we're all grateful for the work that you're doing. So I know, Gordon, you said that you've listened to a couple episodes. So you know what's coming up next. It's one of our favorite parts of the program, and it's called Rapid Fire.
One of our favorite segments on Retail Gets Real is Rapid Fire. Thanks to our sponsor, PwC.
Are you ready?
As ready as I'm going to be.
All right, Sarah, start us off.
Well, since you're familiar with this segment, what question were you hoping to be asked?
You know, we should turn that around sometime. For somebody that's listened to the program, is to ask us the questions. What's always in your refrigerator, Bill?
That was actually one I was afraid to try to figure out. What's always in my refrigerator?
I always ask that question too. So you should have been ready for that. Yeah,
so I guess my answer to that would be grapefruit juice.
Excellent.
That makes smoothies.
Very good. All right, Sarah. All right. Your turn.
You have been so many places, but what's your favorite?
Yeah, since we spent so much time in India, I would call the plane the Taj Mahal. Visited that probably a dozen times during our 5 years in India. It never got old.
Don't even get me started. We may just forget rapid fire. I mean, and just talk about the Taj. That experience, I literally turned the corner at the arch when you walk in, and I literally got teary. It was just such a moment. What an experience. I love that place. I could go back 100 times and I'd still have the same reaction, I think. Anywho, beyond me. So are you a morning person or an evening person?
Morning. Most definitely morning. As long as I have my coffee to get me started.
What kind of coffee?
At this point, it's fair trade coffee. Sold by Equal Exchange, one of our suppliers. And typically, it's a strong coffee, like Sumatran. Stronger, the better.
Amen. Your favorite comfort food?
A hamburger.
Oh, yay.
With all the fixings.
What is your favorite 10,000 Villages purchase?
I love our Phoenician glass. And everything from vases to martini glasses. It just the artistry that is behind that particular product and the designs and the colorful aspect of it. It's my favorite.
Had me at martini glasses. So last question, what is the last book that you've read?
Well, the book that I am currently in the middle of reading,
that's fine,
is a book by someone named Abir Mukherjee, an Indian living in London, but who writes about West Bengal, about Calcutta. And so the currently one I'm reading, they're a mystery series. So
oh, cool.
Right now it's Death in the East.
Well, Sarah, you know, one of the things we should think about just compiling all of these books that our guests have recommended, either that they are reading or have read, because that sounds absolutely fascinating. Mm-hmm. And I think people would really benefit from that, you know, the RGR book club. So, Gordon, good job. And so tell us, where do people go to learn more about 10,000 Villages?
Visit our website at 10,000villages.com. That will have links to stories about us, about our history, as well as into the products available on the e-commerce site. You can also find their locations of all of the stores around the country. And if you happen to live in Washington, D.C. or the environs, you can certainly visit our store in Alexandria. Wonderful store staffed by passionate people.
Sarah, where is that store?
It is on King Street in Old Town.
Very good. Sarah, thank you so much once again for co-hosting.
My pleasure. Nice to meet you, Gordon.
It's always a joy. And Gordon, thank you so much for taking the time and making us more knowledgeable about 10,000 Villages, the work that you're doing globally and the impact that you're having. It's absolutely a fantastic story. And we love to tell those stories. You're a great retailer. Thank you.
Thanks for this opportunity. It's been great to be with you.
And thank you all for listening to another episode of Retail Gets Real. You can find more information about today's discussion and more at retailgetsreal.com. And please send your feedback and episode ideas to podcast@nrf.com. Since we're still in a pandemic, I'm going to close the way we've been closing for the last year. Please be safe. Stay well. Thanks again. We'll see you next time.